Well, where does life live? The crust. So that's where we should see the evidence for God's intervention there.
Where did the carbon go then?
Where did the carbon go?
Yeah.
Dissipated into outer space. Well, as I mentioned, this solar nebula would have begun with a little less carbon than we'd otherwise expect because of the unusual birthing circumstances for the sun. But the vast majority, the loss of carbon and nitrogen occurred with the moon-forming event. So, because that caused all the light stuff to disappear. That's also where we lost most of our water. So planet Earth, in fact, models for forming Earth-type planets show that you're going to get between 10 and 50% water. Now, by the way, that's for the entire planet, not just the crust. The entire planet should be between 10 and 50% water, and planet Earth is 0.02% water. Where did we lose most of that water? The moon-forming collision would have caused that water to leave. But as I mentioned, the aluminum 26 in the primordial solar nebula would drive off a lot of the carbon, the nitrogen, and the water. So the solar planetary nebula was carbon, nitrogen, and water poor because of the quantity of aluminum 26. So that's where we lost a lot of these volatiles. But then there was another event that drove off most of the rest. And then you got the late heavy bombardment. And someone before class told me that the late heavy bombardment is what people refer to when the bars have their closing time. So, so anyway.
Don't quit your day
job. Don't quit my day job. All right. Fluorine. We have 50 times as much fluorine as planetary models would predict for the Earth. And that's because the solar nebula had the privilege of being born very close to white dwarf binary stars, which are the most efficient. It's not the only source of fluorine in the universe, but it's the most efficient source of fluorine. And so with these white dwarf binary stars blasting off fluorine through their stellar winds, if the solar nebula indeed formed close to one of those things, that would explain how we got to be so fluorine rich. And by the way, these are all vital poisons, where if you got too much, it will kill you. If you got too little, it will kill you. And so fluorine, for example, is used as a rat poison. And if you take too much of it, that's one that you got to be careful about, these fluorine treatments for your teeth. It's good to have some fluorine, but you don't want too much. So and so we fluoridate our water because we realize that we do need, and by the way, it's not just for your teeth. There are other proteins in the body that require fluorine. And if we were living anywhere else, we wouldn't have the fluorine that would make advanced life possible. And then we look at sodium. We have 20 times as much sodium as these models would predict. And salt is a critical ingredient for us. But again, if you have too much sodium, it's a problem. If you don't have enough sodium, it's a problem. And so, for example, you go to your doctor, you might say, well, there's too much sodium in your diet, and this could lead to heart disease. But the doctor will also get concerned if he sees your blood work and there's not enough sodium in it. And so there's health issues with too much and too little. But it's because we live on a planet that has so much sodium in it that we're able to get the sodium we need for optimal health. Yes?
Why is there more sodium? 20 times more than
other. Well, okay, for some of these, we're not sure why. Sodium, we're not too sure exactly why we got so much, especially because sodium is very close to magnesium in the table of elements, the periodic table. And so this is a mystery that astronomers are still trying to solve. Where do we get all the sodium? And they're looking at Mars and seeing that we have way more sodium than Mars does. So again, you know, how come? And the real big problem is phosphorus. This is a huge mystery. Where do we get all this phosphorus? Because we don't see this quantity of phosphorus anywhere in the solar system. We just see it here on Earth. As we've been looking out in the Milky Way galaxy searching for phosphorus, it's incredibly at low abundance. On the other hand, we all understand that life is only possible here on planet Earth in the abundance that it is because of the phosphorus that we have. Phosphorus is a critical ingredient for DNA and RNA. You can't join the nucleotides together without the phosphates. And moreover, you've got something called ATP, which is a phosphate mineral that is a storehouse for energy in all animals. Yes.
Could the sodium have come from the salt water in the earth?
Well, that's where sodium is. It's in the oceans. You've got lots of sodium there, but where did Earth get all of its sodium? Now, that's the big issue.
Well, wasn't the land covered at one time with water? There's been floods.
No, the problem, Al, is here you've got the planet. You know, it's one thing to move the sodium around on planet Earth, but where did the primordial sodium come from? How come planet Earth wound up with 20 times as much sodium as what we'd expect for an Earth-sized planet? That's the real issue. But, of course, you're raising another point. In order for the sodium to be optimal for all life, it's important that it be recycled. And so we have salt mines, we have salt in the ocean, and it gets recycled. In fact, what's interesting, I've run into young Earth creationists who claim that salt is a proof for a young Earth. And their whole point is if you've got salt running into the oceans from river flow, that salt will accumulate, and if it's billions of years old, then our oceans should be a lot saltier than they are. But what they fail to take into account, salt gets recycled. The oceans get recycled. The continents get recycled. And so the salt simply moves through the environment. But one of the amazing things about planet Earth is how efficiently the sodium moves, and also the phosphorus. Unless you design the planet just right, even if you have a phosphorus-rich planet, it's all going to wind up in one location where it's unavailable for the rest of life. Same thing could happen to the sodium. So if you don't have efficient plate tectonic activity going on and efficient erosion, the sodium won't move as efficiently as it needs to move to make sure that you don't poison life by having too much in one spot and not enough in other spots. The amazing thing is that the sodium and the phosphorus is so well cycled that all life over the planet Earth gets the just right quantities of phosphorus and sodium it needs. Yes?
How does the sodium get recycled out of the ocean? I thought that was the dead end place of sodium.
Well, what happens in oceans and big lakes and seabeds is that they can get trapped, and then the water evaporates, and you've got a salt bed. And so, for example, we have huge salt mines here in North America. And that's because 200, 300, 400 million years ago, there was a shallow sea over what is now the American prairie. And because of plate tectonic activity, that sea got isolated from the rest of the oceans, dried up, and formed these salt deposits. And, you know, the question is, where do the rivers get its salt to move into the ocean? Well, the salt that's being driven off by rainfall across the landmass in the oceans, that came from previous ocean beds that got lifted up through plate tectonics. So there is this, pardon me?
Aren't the oceans just getting saltier and saltier as time goes on?
Some oceans are getting saltier. Some are getting less salty. So there is a recycling of the salt. And it is a complex recycling mechanism. And without aggressive plate tectonics and aggressive erosion, you need both. You need aggressive erosion and aggressive plate tectonics to make both of these elements recycled efficiently enough that you don't want, because these are both vital poisons. If you get too much of this stuff, you're in trouble. If you get too little, you're in trouble. And because God wants life to be abundant over the entire surface of the planet, it's important that you don't wind up with a whole bunch of salt in one place and not enough somewhere else. And so we live in a planet that fortunately has that recycling. But in both cases, astronomers here can't figure out, at least yet, how we got to have four times more phosphorus than we should have and 20 times as much sodium as we should have. Question back here?
No, Russ says that's because of fast food.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you for that insight. What did we do before fast foods? Okay, moving on. You know, we went through this last week, so I'm going to move through this quickly to get to some new material here. Sulfur. We have 60 times less sulfur than what we'd expect with these planetary formation models. And as we go to Venus and we go to Mars, we see it has much more sulfur than what our planet does. We have yet to measure accurately the sulfur quantity on Venus. We do know it's much richer, at least an order of magnitude richer than the Earth has. But recently, they did measure the sulfur quantity on Mars. It's 50 times what we have here on Earth. And with 50 times as much sulfur, it's way too toxic for life. And so we know that there can't be an origin of life on Mars or the survival of life on Mars just because the quantity of sulfur that exists there. Potassium is something you've got to have in your diet. And if we didn't have potassium, we would all die. But notice that it's 90 times more abundant in the crust of the Earth than what we'd otherwise expect for the crust of a planet that is the type of a planet Earth. And again, this is a vital poison. Too much in your diet would be a problem. Again, those of you who have your regular checkups and look at your blood work, the doctor gets concerned if the potassium level gets too high, also gets concerned if the potassium level gets too low. And if you actually look at that, there's a rather narrow tolerance on the potassium level that's just right within your body. And so, and then certain foods are richer in potassium than others. And so in that situation, the doctor will advise you to eat certain foods and not eat other foods. One you might not be aware of is vanadium. That is important for a number of proteins in our body. And we have 9 times as much vanadium as we would expect. So we live on a vanadium-rich planet. And that's good. And then we also have 5 times less chromium. And this is interesting because these are relatively close together, again, in the periodic chart of elements. And we have 9 times more vanadium and 5 times less chromium. This, again, is an unsolved mystery as to why our planet has so little chromium and so much vanadium. But it's really good that it's fine-tuned this way because both of these have narrow tolerances on how much chromium you can have before it begins to be deadly. Too little chromium in your diet will kill you. Too much will also kill you. The same thing is true of vanadium. But you know, you'd expect both of these to be on the high side or the low side. Notice one's on the high side and one is on the low side. Yes, you're first.
Where do you get vanadium? I've never heard of that. What food is it in?
It's in a lot of foods. So
small amounts,
yeah. Vegetables especially will have vanadium in it. Less so in meat. If all you eat is meat, you're going to have a problem not getting adequate vanadium in your diet. And because of the way certain Americans eat, especially some of our youth who go to those fast food places and really don't get the variety of diet that they need, they wind up with a vanadium problem or a chromium problem, which is why we have a health food industry where you can go and buy vanadium pills or chromium pills. As I mentioned last week, be careful not to overdose on the vanadium. Some people think when they go to a health food store, more is always better. Well, these are vital poisons. Too much will kill you. Too little will kill you. You want to get it just right. Yes?
When I was beginning of man, was it much different with the numbers?
Well, the thing about early man is that we have good evidence that unlike the Neanderthals, the first humans had a widely varied diet. They ate meat. They ate vegetables. And they ate a huge variety of things, and because of that, they had a pretty decent diet. In fact, some have argued that they had a better balance of these vital poisons than we do, because at that time, when people were growing crops, they were growing crops in soils that hadn't been depleted, and therefore they had actually higher levels of some of these things like vanadium and potassium than we have in our diet today. So. Magnesium, which I don't have up here, is another one. It tends to be on the low side. If you're eating food from agricultural lands that have been exploited for hundreds and thousands of years. So it's always an advantage when you're going into a place where people haven't been growing stuff or haven't been properly following the guidelines you see in the Levitical law about how to take care of the agricultural land. There's a question over here, then I'll come back to here, then over here. Yes.
Yeah, so when a supernova explodes, I guess that's where we came from with all this stuff. Does every supernova have all these
No.
All these chemicals?
There are 3 basic kinds of supernova, and these 3 different kinds of supernova will contribute different sets of these elements. So it's critical the planet Earth form in the vicinity of all 3 kinds. Because if we don't, we're going to be short on some of these elements that we see in the periodic table of elements. But as I mentioned last week, you don't want to be too close to one of those events because it'll destroy your planetary system. You don't want to be too far away because you won't get adequately enriched. And the timing is critical. You want this thing to explode at the moment that you're going to get enrichment of the nebula, because if you come in too late, the planets will have already formed, in which case they won't get the benefit of the enrichment. But if it forms too soon, or the injection comes too soon, it will destroy the nebula. So the timing's got to be just right, and the proximity must be just right. There's a hand right here, yes.
I can understand the problem if we don't have enough of something, but if we had too much, why would we not be able to not take it into our body? What about the plants that we eat? They would take up more, or what?
The plants would take up more, and then you'd wind up taking up more, and that would be a problem.
Why wouldn't the plant just take up what it needs and not more?
Well, they've done experiments. There are certain plants that are able to filter out what they don't really want, and certain plants can't. And even the plants that can, you know, there's limitations. So, for example, my mother, who was a nurse in Montreal during the war, wound up treating a patient who had too much gold.
Too much what?
Too much gold.
Gold.
Yeah. Not in the pocket. We all think it's great to have lots of gold, but this is a person that had too much gold in their body. And it's because they were eating vegetables that were being raised in a place where there was lots of gold in the soil. And so once they, what my mother was saying is that they would bring these special plants right into his room that they knew were coming from very gold impoverished soils, and that's how they cured him. So I mean, strange things can happen. So, yes.
You once said that all the gold has been in a barn.
Oh.
Now, I thought you said that.
Oh, did I say all the gold could fit in a barn?
A barn.
A barn. Okay.
A barn.
Well, of course, barns are different sizes. So.
You know, but I often think of it.
I'm probably not the one who gave that quote, but
I could swear it was there because I thought. Wow.
Well. Gold is going to be on this list, and what we do notice is that our planet, I mean, what's interesting is we have, in most cases, a superabundance of a lot of these heavy elements. But when it comes to gold, we're five times short.
Right.
We have five times less gold than we should have, and that's a huge mystery. Given the fact that we're blessed with all these heavy elements, why is gold one of the heavy elements on the downside? And moreover, most of the gold that we do have comes from one location. You know, as most of you know, it's South Africa, where you get about 80% of the world's gold being mined. And what's interesting about South Africa, near Johannesburg, there is an ancient crater. And evidently an asteroid hit in South Africa that was super enriched with gold, and they've been mining that gold. But you can imagine, if it wasn't for that asteroid, we'd be even less abundant in gold than we are. But again, it's good not to have too much gold in the soil. Too much gold in the soil is going to cause health problems.
Where did, because I'm reading the Old Testament, you know, again, and where did they get all that gold for to make all the temples? And the, I mean, they had a lot.
Well, gold isn't that abundant here on planet Earth, but it sticks out like a sore thumb because it doesn't erode well. Therefore, you can find these little tiny nuggets that you don't really have to refine. They're basically pure gold. And so in that sense, it's a little easier to find and refine than the other stuff. So even though there isn't a lot of it, it stands out. It's got an unusual color, so it's easy to see. It's heavy, so when you pick it up, you know it's not fool's gold. And it tends to not corrode, so in that sense, it's easy to recover, but you don't get a lot of it. So that's one reason why it was used for money, because it's not, you know, very abundant. Yeah, John.
Last I recall, that the total amount above the surface that's in use or in mine is around 130,000 tons, and that would fit into a few hundred thousand cubic feet. So it is conceivable a large barn.
Really?
There you go.
Okay, there's your expert back there.
Well, I'm sure you said that.
Yeah. But you know, the one thing that always bothered me when I was a kid watching these westerns back in the 50s and 60s is seeing these robbers carry out this huge chest of gold. Gold is the densest element, and it's like, what is it, 28 grams per cubic centimeter? And so, yeah, heavier than lead. And so there's no way you're going to be able to haul a chest of gold around.
What was the
That was just right. The gold tablets would have been too heavy for him. Yeah, right.
So,
right. Okay.
I was wondering what the patient that had excessive gold, what the problems did that patient have?
Well, I'd have to talk to my mother, and she passed away a few years ago, so but I do remember hearing this story when I was growing up about this patient of hers that had a gold problem. And, you know, it was always a big joke in our house, this guy who had too much gold. And I said, oh, gee, I'd like to meet that guy. Anyway, over here.
John, it causes greed.
Causes greed. Back here. Yes, Dave.
It's very interesting. One of the things that the what they're doing now when you have land that's polluted with too much lead is they found a particular plant that loves to absorb lead. And that's how they clean up the soil now, is by planting this plant over the areas has too much lead. You plant the plant several times. They actually pull up the plant and treat it as, you know, toxic waste. And after 4 or 5 years, this plant will get all the lead out of the soil.
Right. Well, that's true of a lot of these elements, Dave, is that there are bacteria and plants around that will help recycle these things so you don't have regions on the planet where you got too much. So, but yeah, South Africa is a place where you got to watch out for gold, but that's all because of that one asteroid that hit a couple of hundred million years ago. Yes?
I actually did have a serious question.
Okay, sorry.
with all this design evidence rolling in month after month, year after year, isn't it getting increasingly more difficult for secular scientists to try to explain this stuff? How are they dealing with it?
Well, as I mentioned last week, this is something that's new. If you look in the astrophysical literature, you will not really see hard numbers for all these things. I literally had to spend a week going through all the spectral charts and trying to convert the logarithmic values into real numbers that I can compare with the abundances in the crust of the Earth. So this is something we're going to be developing at Reasons to Believe as a new evidence for the supernatural design of the Earth. But yeah, this is not, you know, common knowledge, at least at this point. Although for some of these there are. I mean, what you will find in the scientific literature are articles that will deal with individual elements here. For example, I wrote in today's New Reason to Believe about the sulfur problem. But, you know, kind of the way the papers are written is, you know, isn't it interesting that Mars has got 50 times as much sulfur as we do, and that seems to be the standard everywhere in the universe, and the Earth has so little sulfur, I wonder why. And it kind of stopped there. But, you know, clearly we can look at the late heavy bombardment as an event that drove a lot of surface sulfur into the interior of the Earth. And so with that context, we can explain this. And again, this is bringing up the problem. There's a real need for interdisciplinary research. Most scientists are hyper-specialized, so they don't realize that a paper they're writing, say, on sulfur and Mars has implications that are much broader than that. So, anyway, we're still developing this. We're not done with it yet. But moving on, we also have a nickel problem with planet Earth. We have 20 times less nickel than we should. And nickel is a vital poison. You only need a tiny amount of it in your diet, but you do need some. It's one of these things where if you've got too much or too little, it will kill you. And nickel is somewhat like gold. Most of the crustal nickel exists in one location, a place in Canada, Sudbury, where they can also document that an asteroid hit there, an asteroid that was nickel-rich, and indeed we recognize a number of asteroids are quite rich in both nickel as well as cobalt. And so here we have cobalt on the list. It's 5 times less, and nickel is 20 times less than what we would otherwise expect. Usually where you got iron, you got cobalt and nickel. And this is one of the interesting things about planet Earth. Earth is iron rich, but cobalt poor and nickel poor. So this is an enigma. You know, why we have all this iron, but so little nickel and cobalt, where everywhere else in the universe, we see that the ratio of cobalt to iron and nickel to iron is virtually a constant. But this is crucial for life to exist here on planet Earth, that we make sure we don't have too much cobalt. In fact, you really don't want to be taking cobalt salts as a nutrient supplement. You're going to get plenty of cobalt in your diet, and a tiny amount of extra cobalt will prove quite deadly. It is a problem. And the same thing is true of nickel, although it's not quite to the same degree of a risk as a cobalt is. And then we have selenium, which is kind of where we ended up last week. And selenium is becoming a health issue, and doctors are now warning people to stop their selenium supplements. Because people thought, well, selenium is good for brain function, and indeed it is. And people thought, well, I just load up with selenium, and I can really ace all these tests I'm taking. Well, selenium can prove quite deadly if you get too much of it in your diet. And it's not so much that it's deadly is that it can bring harm to your internal organs, and it won't necessarily kill you right away, but it could shorten your lifespan just by loading up on too much selenium. And there's really no proof to the fact that it's going to make you smarter by taking selenium supplements, although it is crucial for certain brain functions. But here again, we see our planet has been blessed with a lot less selenium than we would otherwise expect. If we had the normal amount of selenium, there'd be no possibility for advanced life here on a planet Earth. And then here's another enigma here. Molybdenum and selenium are close together in the chart periodic table. And yet we see we got 5 times more molybdenum and 30 times less molybdenum. Molybdenum is a vital poison for advanced life forms, but molybdenum is also crucial to facilitate nitrogen fixation in the soils. And so this is crucial also for the plants, that there be sufficient molybdenum that they can get the adequate nitrogen fixation going on for things to work out well for them. That's where we ended up last week. And now I want to introduce to you tin. You might not think that tin is an important nutrient, but it is. You got to have it in your diet. So make sure you get adequate tin. And there's 3 times more tin in the crust of the earth than you'd otherwise would expect. Now, typically, when I was going through this thing, my rule of thumb was if it's not 5 times more or 5 times less, I'm not going to bother with it. As you can see, this is not a complete sample here, although we may do that one of these days. But the reason why we picked up on tin as well as iodine, both of them are 3 times more abundant than otherwise would be, is that these are extremely fine-tuned nutrients in our diet, in a sense that we all know too much iodine is a problem, but too little is. In fact, there was a big concern 50 years ago that Americans and Canadians weren't getting adequate iodine in their diet, and so they began to iodize salt. So when you buy salt today for human consumption, it is enriched with iodine, because there's a recognition that we typically don't get enough iodine in our diet. And likewise, tin is like iodine in the sense that all you got to do is go up a little tiny bit or down a little bit, and you're going to have health issues. And, you know, 100 years ago, this wasn't recognized. Now doctors are watching out on the abundance of tin and iodine that show up in your body. So now I want to look at vital metals. These are not vital poisons, they're vital metals. Vital metals for advanced global human civilization. So these are things where we don't have to worry about having just the right amount in our diet. Most of these are things you don't want in your diet. And so, for example, aluminum. Too much aluminum would be a real problem in your diet, but most of us don't have to worry. We can tolerate quite a bit of aluminum. In fact, there's a number of food additives where they have aluminum in them. I think, what's this thing they put for a coffee substitute? That usually has aluminum in it, and Alka-Seltzer has aluminum in it, I think. So there's a few, pardon me?
Pickles.
So, and that's because the human body can tolerate quite a bit of aluminum. We only know it's a toxic problem if you get a whole lot of aluminum in your body. And I say, because of the aluminum-26, which is a big factor of driving off the nitrogen and the oxygen and the water from the planet, so we could actually have continents and oceans and a thin atmosphere that make possible advanced life, that means we wind up with a lot of aluminum-27. Aluminum-27 is not radioactive. But the beauty of aluminum being so abundant in the crust of the Earth, it's actually the third most abundant element in the crust of the Earth. Let's see, it's oxygen's first, silicon is next, and aluminum is third. And because aluminum is at that high abundance level, we can actually exploit aluminum as a metal. if it was less abundant, it simply would be too expensive to pull out. Matter of fact, until the 20th century, aluminum was not exploited by human beings. That's because it was just too expensive to pull out. The raw problem is aluminum is highly reactive, and so it reacts with lots of other elements. And therefore, when you try to mine the stuff, you find that it's at such a low abundance level because it's mixed in with everything else that it takes a lot of effort to pull out the pure aluminum. Matter of fact, aluminum exploitation really didn't become prevalent until we had widespread electricity. And that's really the primary way aluminum is extracted. Because you take bauxite, you heat it up into kind of a liquid, and then you use electrolysis to pull off the aluminum. Well, unless you've got abundant, cheap electricity, that's simply not practical. And so aluminum, for example, was first extracted in places where they had water power, where it was so cheap that they could actually use it to exploit aluminum. So that's what's interesting. You know, where is aluminum being produced these days? Not where it's being mined. I mean, typically they mine the bauxite down in Suriname, ship it up to coastal British Columbia, where they got super abundant water power, and then that's where the aluminum comes from. In fact, a place not too far from where I grew up, the electricity was so cheap nobody turned off the lights. I mean, it was ridiculously inexpensive, a fraction of a penny per kilowatt hour. So doesn't that make all of us jealous? And it's still that cheap up there. But because water power is so abundant, that's where they smelt the aluminum. Yes?
Now, aluminum foil and tin foil?
That's all. Tin foil is aluminum.
It is.
Right.
And that is that aluminum, they make the aluminum foil?
Right.
And is that okay to cook on that? Or?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can tolerate quite a bit of aluminum in your body without a risk. So using aluminum foil is not going to inject so much aluminum into your body that it's going to be a problem. So, and, of course, the beauty of aluminum for a high-technology civilization, it's a light metal that doesn't corrode. So once you actually manufacture this stuff, it's expensive to manufacture, and that's why you have to have so much. If it wasn't this abundant, we would never be able to exploit it. But because it is so abundant, it's exploitable with modern technology, and now we have the benefit of a light metal that doesn't corrode. Okay, several hands. I think you were first, then we'll cut around back here.
Years ago, when I took a tour of the Washington Monument in Washington, D.C., they said when it was built, the very tip of it was made with aluminum.
Right.
And at the time, it was worth more by weight than gold because they didn't have a good way of
right. Yeah, in the early part of the 19th century, aluminum was more precious than gold and silver. So it's really only been through the use of electric power from water, hydropower, that we've been able to get large quantities of aluminum. And those of you who are older will remember that aluminum was crucial for the victory of the Allies in World War II. Russia didn't have aluminum. Germany didn't have much aluminum. But because North America was able to produce large quantities of aluminum, we could make these lightweight aircraft that were still quite sturdy, and that was a big factor in winning the war. And the first thing Stalin asked for when Germany invaded them, he asked Britain and Canada and the U.S. to send them aluminum. He says, that's the most crucial ingredient we need to deal with the Nazis. So, I mean, we all take aluminum for granted today, but I mean, just go back to your grandfather's generation. Aluminum was a precious element. In fact, I remember my mother telling me when I was 5 years old that when she was growing up, there was only one family in her neighborhood that had aluminum cooking pots because they were such a precious element at that time. Yeah, John.
Well, I was just going to mention the big threats to excess of aluminum are baking powders, some of them, and acids.
Yeah, antacids, right.
The odorants you can get, transdermal absorption. Yeah. And the only hazard with aluminum cookware is cooking acid foods like tomatoes and all that can react and get a little more aluminum in there. But the other sources turn out to be far more problematic.
Right. So good for that. There was one more hand I was missing. Maybe not. Okay. Moving on. Aluminum is 40 times more abundant. And if it wasn't, we wouldn't have any of that aluminum to exploit for industry. And then there's calcium. Calcium is crucial for advanced animals. But it's such that you really don't have to worry about too much calcium. It's the opposite of aluminum in the sense that, you know, if you don't have aluminum, no big deal. You don't need aluminum. The body doesn't need any aluminum at all, and too much is a problem. The body definitely needs calcium, but if you've got too much calcium, that's not an issue. The body can handle, you know, almost unlimited amounts of calcium. But because calcium is 20 times more abundant than we'd otherwise expect for a planet like Earth, that means we can use this for technology. And, you know, calcium shows up in things like marble, cement, and so, you know, building materials, building blocks, limestone, all this makes possible the structures that we see here, our freeways and everything else. Now, another element that we find is kind of like aluminum. It's light and very strong. We're talking about titanium. So titanium is actually stronger than steel, but it's not as abundant as steel. But notice it's 65 times more abundant than we would otherwise expect. This, again, is a mystery. Astronomers do not yet know why we're so titanium-rich. It's easy to explain how we could be 20 times more wealthy in titanium than we would otherwise expect from the late heavy bombardment and the moon-forming event. But 65 times is a real stretch. How come we have that much titanium? And there's research going on now about are there events that would have been in the emerging solar nebula, it's a star cluster, where it could have come into contact with extra titanium, because we do see the sun seems to have a little bit of an extra abundance of titanium as well. But because we got 65 times more than otherwise expect, it's actually possible for us to exploit titanium for building materials. And just a little tip, when you fly, make sure you're flying with an airline that uses airplanes that contain titanium. Aeroflot does not, so avoid the Polish airlines and the Russian airlines because they don't use titanium. I mean, it's a relatively expensive metal, but because there is so much of it, it's actually possible for us to exploit titanium. And of course, titanium has big medical advantages today in terms of prosthetics. This is really the element you want. It's light and very strong, and something that you can use for an artificial limb that will last you the rest of your life. Yes?
Not only is it light and strong, but I have a tooth implant. You said they used to use a post of some other kind of metal, and the bone would recede. But they use the titanium post, and the bone likes it. The bone actually grows to it and fuses with the
right,
titanium.
Right, right, right. So, yeah, I remember my dentist. I got a post, too. So the dentist was explaining how titanium was that one element where the calcium will bond with it. Well, notice they're relatively close together. And so evidently the calcium will bond with the titanium, and you're in good shape because of that. In the back, pardon me?
Right. My friends, and you heal terrific with them.
Right. And titanium is springy, too. So, you're loaded with titanium, aren't you?
It's been great, I'll tell you.
It's unbelievable.
Right. Yeah, it feels just like, well, again, the reason why it works is because look how close it is to calcium in terms of its weight. So it's fairly lightweight. It's very strong, nice and springy, and will last you for the rest of your life. Yeah, Jackie. No, that's probably only true of gold and nickel.
Oh, really?
So we got extra enriched with nickel and gold, you know, at least in part due to asteroid collisions in the relatively recent past. Well, in most cases, the enrichment took place when the Earth was less than 50 million years old. In the case of sulfur, the key event was 700 when the Earth was 700 million years old. But yeah, for the gold and the nickel, we look to events that are approximately 200 million years ago. So, Yeah, it's complicated. You can't just pinpoint one source in each of these cases. So.
Well, yeah, but I was thinking you said the asteroid that caused the boom was in South Africa. Well, then other parts of the Earth, are there concentrations of these elements, or are they just broadside?
Yeah, gold tends to be concentrated in certain parts of the planet, so it's not evenly distributed. So, but yeah, as I was explaining, my mother was actually treating a patient that lived in a gold-rich area, and that was an issue. So don't hang around with too much gold. So, yeah. Don't worry, eh? Not a problem for you. All right.
Can I bring you back to the question of aluminum toxicity, especially with cooking? You said it's only toxic, or it only releases toxicity in the presence of high-acid foods?
Well, that's what John was saying. High acid, high temperature. So, yeah, if you've got aluminum cookware, you're advised not to push the temperature above 400 degrees. And, yeah, try to avoid cooking a lot of acidic foods in there. So, but again, the body is reasonably tolerant to aluminum. If it gets up to a high level, then it's a problem.
But it gets in the brain.
It can get into the brain, right.
But only so. Under those conditions, over 400 degrees.
Yeah, if you want to avoid the high temperature and the high acids. So. Okay. Yeah, have you got. Pardon me? Yeah, high antiperspirants have lots of aluminum in them. And I think there's certain kinds of coffee mates you've got to watch out for and antacids. Anyway, moving on. Yes.
Is alum from the word aluminum?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, Al.
How do they measure? Is this the stuff they kind of measure in rocks?
Okay, all these numbers are integrated over the entire crust of the Earth. So this is including the crustal material at the bottom of the oceans, as well as in the continent of the land masses. And so what geologists do is they kind of take samples literally all over the world, average and come up with these numbers. So I mentioned last week, we do have fairly accurate abundance levels for the crust of the Earth. And also for the sun. A little more challenging to get accurate numbers that would pertain to the entire Milky Way galaxy, which is kind of what I had to do. I actually go through the spectra and to pull that out. So in some cases they're very accurate, some cases they're not that accurate, which is another reason why I tried to limit this to places where you've got a clear super or under abundance. Let me give you a couple more. Maybe these are elements you haven't heard of. Yttrium and niobium. Yeah, you might want to invest in these two metals, okay? Huh? How do they come up with these names? Well, often they come up with them because they're named after the person that discovered the element, or they're named after a friend of the discoverer of the element. So I don't know about yttrium. So. Well, that's kind of that's the naming convention. Okay, let me give you a trivia question. You know about all the elements in the periodic table? What's the one letter of the alphabet you'll never see?
X.
You will see X. You will see Q. In fact, there's a whole bunch of them that have got the letter Q in it.
Y?
No, there's a Y right there. W? No. Who said J? J's right. It's the only letter you won't find anywhere in the table of elements. That's just a trivia question. Why? I have no idea. I could make a joke, but I'm going to refrain from the joke. Okay. yttrium and niobium are incredibly superabundant in the crust of the Earth compared to what we would expect. And again, this is kind of a mystery as to why Earth wound up with so much yttrium and niobium. Now, neither of these elements have been exploited until recently. It's probably why most of you probably haven't heard of these elements. But now they're realized as being vital elements for modern technology. The reason why is that yttrium and niobium are the two elements that we see in the table of elements that allow for high temperature superconductivity. So when you make compounds with yttrium and niobium, you can get high enough. In fact, there are now work and showing that you can actually use these two to get superconducting conditions under liquid nitrogen temperatures. Now, the problem is right now we can only do that with relatively, it's with ceramics, but the problem with these ceramics is it's hard to mold them in such a way that you can get long pipes. It's hard to make a pipe out of ceramics. And so there's research going on right now to work with these elements to see if we can have them combine with compounds that will allow for malleable piping that we could use for superconductivity. But you can see the advantage here. Typically, superconductivity requires liquid helium. And the liquid helium is not only relatively rare on the Earth, it's very hard to keep under liquid conditions. Typically, you've got to cool it down to 4 degrees above absolute zero, which means you need to pour a lot of money into actually pumping the thing to keep it that cold. And the big problem with helium is it leaks like crazy. It'll leak through almost anything. And any of you who have done work with liquid helium know what a job it is to try to close off all the leaks. I did experiments when I was in a physics lab, and often you work for 3 or 4 days straight just trying to clip off all the leaks. And this is really what happened with the superconducting or the Large Hadron Collider in Europe, is they had a problem with the leaks. And, you know, they're going to have ongoing problems with leaks. And it's one of the reasons why the United States shut down the project in Texas. The project in Texas, I think, was about a 57-mile particle accelerator, which would have been about 4 times bigger than the one in Europe. But one of the reasons why they closed it down is they couldn't solve the superconducting problem. They could, but by using liquid helium, they knew they were going to have constant issues with leaks, as the Europeans are finding with their system with the Large Hadron Collider. But with these two elements, they hold the promise that we can have superconductivity with liquid nitrogen, not liquid helium. Nitrogen is abundant. It's easy to cool. I mean, you see trucks all along the freeway all the time hauling liquid nitrogen, and it doesn't leak like liquid helium does. Now, a question I haven't answered is, why do you want superconductivity? Well, a basic condition you get with superconductivity is zero electrical resistance. And with zero electrical resistance, you can imagine there are really enormous industrial payoffs if you can get zero electrical resistance at relatively low cost. Well, these are the elements that are going to make that possible. And already we're finding some benefits here, but notice how abundant they are to what we would normally expect. Yes?
Is niobium a magnetic or paramagnetic, or does it have special magnetic qualities?
Yes, it is. So it has some other industrial applications besides superconductivity. Likewise, yttrium is not just limited superconductivity for its benefits. So yeah, you might want to try to invest a little bit in your yttrium and niobium in your portfolio. So, yes.
There's a question tied up in your title, vital metals. These later metals, I don't think, are vital to us living. But did God look forward and say, as part of making the earth a rich place for people to live, I want to put these in so that their later high technology would be enhanced?
Yeah, that's exactly my argument, is that they are vital for advanced global high technology civilization. And it's like God anticipated that the human species would reach that level of technology, so in advance he provided us with these elements. Because I can tell you this, nobody even bothered with yttrium and niobium until about 20 years ago. They were completely ignored. It wasn't mined, people just leaving it alone, because they thought these elements had no use, and they're kind of wondering, you know, why do we have so much of this stuff anyway? We can't see any use for it. Well, now we realize there's use for it. In fact, it probably wouldn't be a bad idea from a Christian paradigm to be looking at the elements of the earth where we see these anomalies and say, wow, this one is anomalous. Maybe God had some reason for putting it there. Let's see what that reason is. But in this case, we've already stumbled upon it. This is one that allows for high temperature superconductivity. And incidentally, even if we don't solve the problem of coming with long malleable tubes, the fact is that these are able to operate at such high temperatures, even if it's not liquid nitrogen temperatures, high enough temperatures where you're not going to run into the serious problems with helium, because you could actually have a mixture of that and other liquids, and so it'd be easier. Yes, go ahead.
Professor Fairmont Meadows, I heard that magnets actually helps your lower back and your bone. What is it in magnets that makes that happen?
Well, that's a bit of a medical myth that magnets are going to cure you. And also it's a bit of a myth that if you put magnets around your water pipes, it's going to pull out all the nasty chemicals in your water. It won't work. And for the same reason, it's not going to do much. I mean, it does have a minor effect, but the effect is so minor, you might as well not wear the magnet at all. So I remember about 15 years ago, there were people wearing these magnetic bracelets, thinking that was going to help their health.
My uncle uses it. Behind the speakers, there's this huge magnet that he puts behind them, and says all the pain goes away because they're so big, the magnets.
Some of
that's small.
The placebo, obviously. Some of it's the power of the mind.
Yeah. You heard that? So it's the placebo effect. If you believe it works, it'll work. In the back.
If you go Shazam and shuffle all our vital deposits and vital poisons down to the average, would life be sustainable on Earth?
If you were to take all of these elements and put them where we would expect them to be if planet Earth formed the way planets normally form, we wouldn't be able to be here. So,
perfect time to end.
All right. Okay. Next week we'll talk about gold and lead and uranium and thorium, all the really heavy stuff. And it's really good that we have lots of this heavy stuff and not much of that heavy stuff. And anyway, and then we'll get back into Psalm 139. And a wonderful passage here I can kind of read for you here. You created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in a secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. I think that applies to our planet as well as to each one of us as an individual human being. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we want to thank you, Lord, for the privilege of living in the 21st century, where we're seeing all these revelations coming through your book of nature. Thank you, Lord, that we have people involved in scientific research that are literally doubling our knowledge base every 4, 5, or 10 years. And Father, help us to see how this new revelation can increase not only our faith, but the faith of people who don't yet know you as Lord and Savior. And Lord, we thank you for these creation psalms. And Lord, thank you for the way they integrate through all the different bodies and life forms you made for our special benefit. Thank you, Lord, for your great love being bestowed upon each one of us. In Jesus' name, amen.
Calcium candy toxic.
You take lots of it?
When my mom passed away, she had her calcium pills. And I was...
Good stuff, huh?